The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt. Welcome to the interview with Hugh Hewitt, sponsored by AndrewandTodd.com. Andrew and Todd are with Sierra Pacific Mortgage. They help you with all your real estate lending needs. If you're refinancing your home, if you're buying a new home, if you're a senior who wants a reverse mortgage, or if you're a veteran who doesn't want to put any money down, whatever it is, if you're in the private real estate market for yourself, and maybe you want an investment property, try AndrewandTodd.com or call 888-1172. Now on to the interview with Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. In the 23 years I've been doing this national show, one of my favorite guests has been and remains David Gergen. You've seen David on CNN and PBS for years. If you've been a student at Harvard at the Kennedy School of Government, you've probably taken his class. He's a professor of public service and founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's a good guy, and he joins me now. He's probably in Boston. He's probably rooting for the Red Sox, and he's probably still wrong about that. Good morning, David. Welcome back. Congratulations on Hearts Touched with Fire.
Terrific, you. I'm so pleased to be here with you. Thank you for you got me out, rousing out of bed. But you're quite where are you at in California?
Oh no, I'm in the D.C. area now. I moved from California back to D.C. Because doing this from 3 to 6 in the morning would be a little bit hard. I go out there in the winter. David, I want to start because there's some people in the audience. I get new affiliates every month, and we got 450 of them right now. I want them to know that you work for RN, you work for Gerald Ford, you work for Ronald Reagan, you work for Clinton, but you had different sort of styles and roles for each of them. Let's start with President Nixon. What did you do in the Nixon White House?
Nixon White House, I came in, I've been in the Navy. I went to law school, and then I went in the Navy for 3.5 years. My last year, Hugh, I was assigned to come to Washington to work on draft reform. That was the time when Nixon had launched a random lottery to determine what draft number you got and whether you're going to go to Vietnam or not. We tried to clean that up. They ran a bogus, in some ways, a random lottery the first year out. I'll tell you, you have time for a little story?
We got lots of time. That's why we can go a long time today.
Okay, super. Well, so Nixon, out of the White House, orders a random lottery determine who goes to Vietnam. The Lewis Hershey was then head of the draft. He was sort of the J. Edgar Hoover of the draft. And so Hershey did something they did back in the Second World War, which was a very popular war. They got a bowl, they got capsules, and they put January 1 in the first capsule, put it in the bowl, and then January 2, all the way to the days of January, then February, all the way up through the days of December, the last one's into the bowl. Got a spoon, stirred it up a little bit, put it in the closet. And then on the day of the random lottery, they brought it to bowl, reached in for number one, you go to Vietnam, and it was like November 15th. And all of the early numbers and all of the early draws, you know, were from late in the year. So the whole thing was tilted, in a way.
How interesting.
So, yeah, it was very interesting. And then our charge was, a small little group, was to come up with a truly random system by public trust. And we reached out to a statistician named Tukey, who was a Princeton man, who was a leading statistician in the country, and said, how do we run a random lottery that's truly random? And he said, well, listen, get the bowl, get the capsules, but then use a computer to randomly generate the order in which the capsules are put into the bowl. So that makes it truly
random.
That was a good idea. So
it was.
My contributions to this were two. I said, listen, some senator's son is still going to get a very high number. They're going to think it's fixed in the bowl. So let's have two bowls, put January through December in one bowl and the numbers 1 through 365 in the other bowl, and then draw simultaneously from the two bowls and match up the number, the date with the number.
Oh,
there's nobody can say that's not random.
No, double randomized trial. My brother won the lottery. He ended up being, he's the last Hewitt boy that was eligible, and he was in the high 200s, and he didn't go.
Yeah.
And so that meant a lot to people.
Sure. Well, listen, so my other contribution was, listen, let's find two young blonde girls, very innocent looking, fairly short skirts, and have them do the drawing. So we had the first Randall White, was that, who was that woman who used to put things up? At any rate, it went dense. What I discovered about government, and it's gone with me the rest of my life, is part of it is about business and real policy, and that's meaningful. But also, there's part of it that's about show business.
There's also part of it that is storytelling, as you talk about in Hearts Touched with Fire.
Yes.
You also work for Ford. Now, Jerry Ford, Jim Cavanaugh is the chairman of my board at the Nixon Library, the chairman of the Ford board. And we've talked a lot about Nixon and Ford and their differences. Jerry Ford could never get elected president from the go. I mean, he could have won re-election. He could have won in 76 had things broken differently. Parked. What'd you do for Ford?
What did I do for Ford? Well, I stuck around. During the Nixon years, I was first hired by Ray Price to come in and be his assistant. Ray was running a speechwriting shop, speechwriting and research. And I was his sort of go-to gopher guy. I was very junior at the time. I got promoted up through the ranks. And then Ray at one point said, I'd like to be sort of a senior counselor. And I was asked by Bob Haldeman if I would run the speechwriting and research shop. So which I did. And for about a year, year and a half, and through some pretty tough times, as you recall. But in any event, by that time, I was sort of in. And when Ford came in, they named a replacement for me without asking. I immediately was looking around for a job, and I called Bill Simon, who was Treasury Secretary, and had become a friend. And he said, listen, come work for me. So I went over to the Treasury Department for about a year. And over there, I tried to teach them about politics, at least to the extent I understood it, and they tried to teach me about economics.
You see, David, when I read Hearts Touched with Fire, it's kind of like a diary for me, because the wonderful and great Ray Price brought me to San Clemente to be a ghostwriter for Nixon in his exile.
Right?
And as mentors. And this is a book about mentoring. And so I wanted to bring that up. But I also want people to know, I went to work in the White House as a young lawyer for Fred Fielding in the Reagan years, but you were kind of higher in the chain of command. I'd see you in the mess, but I wouldn't talk to you because you didn't talk to the people higher in the chain. tell us what you did in the Reagan years.
Well, in the Ford years, eventually, let me tell you one little Ford story.
Please.
You have time?
Oh, yes.
So Ford, as you recall, this is a real story about his staff, actually. As you recall, Ford was giving, when I went back, I was invited by Ford to come back. Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney reached out and said, come on back to the White House under Ford, which I did. And I was sort of named, some advisor to the president. I was still fairly junior. The speech writing process in there was excruciating, because the way we would review for speech where the president was about to make was on Mondays we would get together and we'd have all the speeches he was going to give that week. We'd have drafts. And we'd sit down, and nobody had ever seen, except in the speechwriting staff, nobody had ever seen the speeches until we got into that meeting. And then the way we critiqued the speech was everybody would go to page one of the speech, and we'd read it for the first time. And then we would make comments about where what needed to be changed. Then we'd go to page two and page three. It was excruciating. I couldn't stand it because we never read the full speech. We had no idea where the speech was going. And it was like, and we wound up giving a lot of speeches were sort of, one-syllable speeches. Dick and Jane. After we left the White House, after Ford was back into private life, about 6 or 8 months in, I got a call from his office saying that President Ford's got a speech he needs to make. He's got a draft. He'd like you to look at the draft. Can he call you at home tonight? I said, sure. So I got the speech. It was elegant. 3-4-syllable words, well constructed, very persuasive. And so I thought it was a beautiful speech. The only problem is it's not a Ford speech.
Uh-huh.
It's not see Dick run.
Yep.
And so he called me that night. And he said, well, what'd you think? And I could hear him puffing away on his pipe. And I said, well, Mr. President, it's a very good speech, but it's not your speech. Do you want me to rewrite it in your hand, in your way of thought? And he started chuckling this. Yeah. And I said, what? Well, what's happening? He said, actually, David, this is the first time I've had space in my life that I could, for a number of years, that I could really write my own speech. This is it. And I thought, oh, my God, for the last 12 to 18 months, we've been having this guy give terrible speeches that aren't his. They weren't, you know, we way oversimplified.
When you came back, the speech writing process when I was a young lawyer was it was staffed around. I remember the Chief Justice of the United States at that time and Associate Counsel arguing with Peggy Noonan. That was a murderer's row of speech writers over which you presided.
Oh, yes. We had Bill Sapphire and Ray Price and Pat Buchanan.
And Nixon, yeah.
And with Nixon, yeah. And then John McLaughlin came in sort of late in the game with Nixon, but you know, he was around for a while.
Ben Stein. Yeah.
So, it was a terrific group, and it was about 50 people. If you look at speech writing and their support staff, and then the research staff, and then we also had the letters and, you know, so correspondence section. So it was about 50 people there, and I ran that for a while.
So let's go to Reagan, because we've got 2 minutes of the break. We'll come back after the break.
Sure.
What happened? What did you do for Reagan?
Well, I then I was very close to Jim Baker, and he was my mentor for much of that time. And during the interim period, when Reagan was, I was in a campaign. I was in two campaigns against Reagan. And the first one we lost, the second one we won, and I was working for George Bush during that campaign. And then Reagan asked the day after he got elected, he asked Baker to be his chief of staff.
Right.
And Baker then reached out to me and to Dick Darman and Craig Fuller to some extent. But there were two groups of people in the Reagan White House. There were the Californians, who tended to be more conservative, but had worked with Reagan, like Ed Meese, had worked with Reagan in Sacramento. And they had a very good relationship, Bill Clark. It was a good group of people. But they were all sort of Californians, had very little Washington experience. So Reagan then assembled a second group, which was headed up by Jim Baker, which we were called the pragmatists, people who were, you know, the Marty Andersons, the conservatives would come up with a policy. It was our role in life as a pragmatist to get them passed, to get things done.
Well, I got to ask you, where does Fred? I had breakfast on Saturday with Fred Fielding and Dick Houser. I always thought the lawyers were a group apart. Where do they fit in your triangulation in the White House? Because basically, Fred took care of Nancy and the president's big stuff.
Oh yeah, well that's right. But I, Fred worked about four doors down the hall from me.
I know you guys are pals.
Yeah, and he's a super guy. But I remember when Nixon resigned, I got a call just after Nixon made his speech on TV. I got a call from Al Haig, who was in the chief of staff. And Haig told me, he said, listen, David, everything has worked out well. We forgot one thing. I said, what's that? He said, we forgot a resignation letter. I said, that's interesting. I'll look forward to reading it. He said, no, you don't understand. I want you to write it. I said, well, what do I say? You know, how do you resign from president of the United States? And he said, I don't know. You figure it out. And so I went down the hall to see our general counsel, thought John Dean could give me some good counsel on how to do it right, properly. And then I was reminded that John Dean was in jail.
Yes.
So we had our general counsel was in the slammer, and that's when I turned to Fred Fielding. And Fred and I worked on it overnight, and he's just a marvelous human being.
And he's a fabulous lawyer.
Yeah, and he's a good lawyer, and, you know, he had this Philadelphia firm he worked with, and yeah, he's very high on my list of people I learned a lot from.
When we come back from break, we're going to talk about President Clinton. I want to get a few stories, and then I want the big takeaways for young people. And boy, there are a lot of big takeaways in Hearts Touched with Fire. I'm going to have Dave Gergen tell a couple of stories. My favorite stories in a book full of them, and my favorite bits of it. I have one disagreement with him, and I'll talk about that too, because it's talk radio. We got to do that. But David Gergen, ubiquitous in your life, whether you knew it or not, for the last many years. And as long as David keeps working, so am I. So don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back with David Gergen. Hearts Touched with Fire, available at Amazon. We'll be right back after the break on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, talking with David Gergen, the author of this brand new book, Hearts Touched with Fire, How Great Leaders Are Made. David had the unusual distinction of crossing over to serve in two White Houses separated by party. He joined the Clinton White House. There he worked with my closest friend in the world, Mark Guerin, who's now the director of the Kennedy Institute of Politics. So he must run into Mark a lot up in Boston. But David, when Bill Clinton asked you to go to work for him, were you surprised? And what did you do for the Democratic president for whom you toiled?
Yes. But first of all, let me just say you and I share a lot of good friends. And Mark Guerin is one of them.
Yep.
He's first class, too. When I was out in the private sector, when Bill Clinton was elected, and I was at that point, I was running U.S. News and World Report. It was my first foray into formal journalism, and I lasted for a couple of years. And it worked out well. But in any event, I wrote editorials for the magazine, and I got a call one day from Mac McClarty, who was the chief, very close to Clinton. He was his first chief of staff, and I think a good one. And he said, "Will you come over and have lunch with me?" And I said, "Sure." The White House mess? Yeah, you bet I'll come
over. You bet. Yeah.
Yeah. So we had lunch, and he said, "Well, you know, we've been reading your editorials about what we ought to do over here, and we think maybe you ought to come here and work on our staff and tell us what to do." And so I was a little bit taken aback by that because I had worked for three Republican presidents, and proudly so. I wasn't as conservative as presidents I'd worked for, but I worked for them with great respect, especially Ronald Reagan. But I also had a lot of high regard for much of what Richard Nixon stood for, as well as Gerald Ford. So but anyway, it was a surprise to me. But while we were sitting there in the basement there where they had a little restaurant, the president himself shows up to talk to me, and I knew that the fix is in here. And so the two of them leaned on me to come and work for Bill Clinton. And I said, you know, it was in a very awkward situation because the partisanship was still pretty high by then. But I'd known Bill Clinton a long time. We had become friends. And I sort of had an old-fashioned view that if the president of the United States calls you and says, "I need help, can you come help me fix what's going on here?" You do it. You
don't. The answer is yes.
Yeah. And then the answer is also, when do I start?
Yeah.
And I told him, Mr. President, I can do this for up to a year, but I don't want to be involved in campaigns against Republicans. That's just it would be too awkward. And so we agreed to that. I settled in as counselor to the president. When I got there, you know, the reason he asked me to come was he was looking for someone to help guide him out of he was floundering. I knew a Bill Clinton who was very self-confident, good, great governor of Arkansas. And the Bill Clinton I found in the White House was despondent. Things weren't going well. He was bouncing around and he was looking for help. And so what I had learned from the Reagan years was when people used to say, "Let Reagan be Reagan." You always play to the president's best instincts, his best qualities, and that will help him more than anything else. And so I had a sort of let Clinton be Clinton approach. And the deal was that I pushed very hard. Don't try to change who this guy is. Don't make him somebody he's not. Let the good Bill Clinton come out and bring back to the fore, you know, Clinton, the best of Clinton. So we created the zone of confidence around him, self-confidence. He'd lost his self-confidence. He was struggling, and Hillary was struggling. She found the transition to Washington very, very difficult. You know, when they lost Vince Foster, there were a whole lot of things going on that were negative. And so in any event, each time the president did something, Bill Clinton did something, he turned to me afterwards and said, "How'd that go? What do you think? What should I do to change?" And gradually he got his self-confidence back. And what I learned is with leaders, you try to help them refine themselves. Don't try to turn them into something that they're not, because that will, the lack of authenticity will really come back to haunt them later on.
Now, so that leads me to two of the story. There are many stories in Hearts Touched with Fire, and I want to use my two favorite, with Bill Clinton in Morocco and with HW in Kennebunkport. Yeah. Do it in the order that you want, because they illustrate magnificent things.
Well, let me start with the order in which they occurred. It was the Kennebunk. With George Bush Sr., George H.W. Bush. This was during the out years, during the Carter years, when Bush was running, wanted to be the next nominee of the Republican Party, and he had a reasonable shot at it. And he was building a staff. he reached out to me. I didn't know him well. He reached out to me and said, would you consider coming on my political staff for the campaign? And I didn't know him well. And I said, well, let me think about it. So the next thing I know, he called and invited me to come stay at Kennebunk for a weekend.
Now, pause right there, David. We got to take a quick break. And I want people to know you're on your way to Kennebunkport to talk with George H.W. Bush. When we take the break, we're going to, on the other side of this break, America, we're not going to have any more breaks. We're just going to talk, so we won't interrupt David anymore. The book is Heart Touched with Fire. The whole podcast and this radio interview will be available later today over at the podcast and on the radio show. I'm going to excerpt some of this tomorrow because you got to hear the story about H.W. and the one about Bill Clinton and where we disagree about young people, where we agree about young people. Hearts Touched with Fire, really wonderful book for young folks and old. Back now on other affiliates and on the Highly Concentrated Hue podcast with David Gergen. When we went to break on the radio show, David, you were saying the George H.W. Bush was running for president in 1980. He wants you to join the team. He invites you up to Kennebunkport.
Yes, exactly. So I get to the airport about 20 miles away, and I'm looking around for a driver. Couldn't find a driver, and I was asked to report to some desk there in the airport terminal, and I did. And there's Barbara Bush and George H.W. Bush, who had driven these 20 miles to go pick me up. And I was like floored. I mean, I just assumed, like, look, I'm pretty much a flunky here. I mean, why you drive? I was very impressed. And then I went home with them to their home. And what I discovered was they had a Democratic congressman as a guest for the weekend, you know, and in a partisan world, that was just sort of unheard of. But I was very pleased to see that because they were friends. They had been longtime friends, and they got together, and I spent a wonderful weekend. Then I was leaving on a Monday morning. I had a plane out of that same terminal at 5:30 in the morning. There was a knock on my door, my bedroom door, and I opened it, and it was George H.W. Bush, and he had a cup of coffee, and he said, "Here, I thought you might need this to get started." And he was so gentlemanly. It was so warm. And when we got to the airport, he said, "You know, I'd like to get to know people before I ask them to serve on my staff, and I'd like to get to know who they really are. And that's why, you know, we behaved the way we did this weekend. We really wanted to get to know who you are."
That's such a takeaway for leaders. Don't hire on resumes. I mean, resumes matter, but don't hire on a resume, because if you don't get along with someone, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton and Morocco.
Bill Clinton and Morocco. So Clinton is makes a trip to the Middle East. It's partly, you know, remember the whole throwing out of the Iraqis Hussein out of Kuwait and everything
Correct.
Like that. I was asked to go with him. We have a party. President usually travels with a party about 10 or 12 people. And then a lot of security and all the rest. But in any event, they asked me to go, and I was delighted. And I'd been to the Middle East with Nixon, but it was always interesting to go back and instructive. But I got back on Air Force One and to come home. And we stopped in to see the King of Morocco on the way home. We arrived at the airport there about 1 a.m. in the morning. We jumped into some vans, went to the palace, had coffee with the king, jumped back into the vans, went back out to the airport, started to fly home to the United States. We spent about 2 hours there on this trip to Morocco, which was one of the most beautiful countries in the world. And so on the way back, I had a chance to talk to Clinton. I said, "You know, Mr. President, this is so different from the way it just illustrates the differences that are between the way we govern today and the way people governed back in the war." And I said to him, "You know, there's a story about Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt during the war. Early on, Churchill was eager to get to know Roosevelt better. He wanted Roosevelt to trust him, and he wanted to be able to, you know, get chips and planes and everything else from Roosevelt." So in any event, the two leaders, Churchill and Roosevelt, agreed to meet in Morocco. And when they got there, Churchill turned to Roosevelt and said, "I'd like you to stay an extra day because I want to show you the sunset in Morocco with the Atlas Mountains." And Roosevelt really didn't particularly want to stay. He wanted to get home. But Churchill said, "No, you have to do this, Mr. President. Come do this." And so they went. And they had to drive 5 hours, I think, from the Capitol out to where we're going to stay. And in the late afternoon, their group of Secret Service guys carried Roosevelt up to the top of this little this building that was, I think it was a religious building of some sort. And Roosevelt and Churchill watched the sunset over the Atlas Mountains. It's a glorious sight. But they bonded during that time, and Roosevelt and Churchill also made a watercolor. He painted a watercolor, and was the only one he did during the war, and gave it to Roosevelt as a friendship sign. But I told Clinton, you know, here it is in the middle of a war, intense war, existential war, that these two men would take a day out to go get bonded and watch the sunset in Morocco, and not be so overcome by the day-to-day, you know, pressures of war. And they were living real lives. They were genuine people. And going to Morocco actually was a really smart use of the president's time. But in the modern day and age with Bill Clinton, you had to fly in and fly out in a matter of 2 hours. You know, in the middle of the night, you didn't see anything. You didn't take advantage of that. I said, Mr. President, you know, it's too bad. You have to rush home, and you can't take advantage of this and sort of, imbibe this kind of environment, because it was so important to the Roosevelt Churchill relationship.
Andrew Roberts unfolded that story in his book Walking with Destiny, and when you recounted it in Hearts Touched with Fire, it reminded me that you can't spend too much time with the people who matter the most on the world stage. And the Absolutely. King of Morocco, it's just unfortunate. Let me turn now. These are just ways of setting up to people that young people who read this book are going to take away some lessons. And I love the network effects are real. You've got to have a network of friends. It's that Guerin connection, for example, the Ray Price connection. We have network effects between and CNN and Jeff Zucker and all these different people. We go on forever. But young people, here's where we might disagree. You begin the book by talking about Greta Thunberg and David Hogg and Daniel Crenshaw, Lieutenant Crenshaw, now Congressman Crenshaw.
Yeah.
And to me, the biggest danger for young people today is celebrity early. Now Crenshaw came to it after being a CEO and losing his eye, but Thunberg and David Hogg came to it early. I mean, it's such a burden, David. You've lived with it for 50 years. You know what it's like to be a celebrity. And do you worry about young people becoming famous too early?
Well, I think that is I think that is a danger. You know, famously, when in politics, it used to be that if you were sort of fairly new to politics and you became a celebrity, say like an Al Haig, when he was over at the State Department, and he was kind of, and they had a cover of Time magazine with him being the vicar,
on
the glove. Yes. He was sort of going to run the world. You know, it was terribly damaging to him inside because people were very resentful, and the celebrityhood had gone to his head. He didn't conduct himself in a way that really sort of made strong friendships. And eventually, you know, the system coughed him out. He didn't fit very well. And eventually Reagan let him go as Secretary of State. I had worked with Al way back in the Nixon days, and he was marvelous at running the country when Nixon was in such trouble. Al Haig kept the government together. But by the time Reagan came along, Haig had become this celebrity figure, and it got in the way. Yeah, so I do think there's a danger of that. I think there's an equal danger for the young people of the millennial generation and Generation Z, even for the Generation X, and this is my personal observation, is they have enormous promise. But there are some people in those groups, you know, who are accused, and I think rightly so, of being very extremely arrogant, being entitled, having a low low drive and low sense of, you know, how you have to work hard to pull something together to make things work. And they just sort of will fool themselves.
You know, you talk a lot about the virtues of modesty, which I greatly appreciate. Now, I know Mark Zuckerberg a little bit. He's not immodest. He is very successful. But you can only have one. I've had dinner with him at his house with a bunch of other conservatives. Yeah. You can only have a dining room table that seats 12 if you want to have a conversation, no matter how many billions you have.
Yes, I agree.
And so a modest life is just fine.
Yes, I have a friend, Jeff Walker, who lives in Florida these days. But he has this whole idea of a Jeffersonian dinner, and that is you put 12 people together, but no more than 12.
Right.
And you have periodic conversations, and people go deep, and they're candid, and those are the good kind of the meals, as opposed to the. I knew one person in the Nixon White House who spent an hour every day finding ways he could get a White House operator to call him somewhere in a public place so that he would be summoned.
And, all right, two more things I want to cover. People have to read. But two more things. The strenuous life. I've never not had four jobs. You're the same way, Gergen. You're everywhere all the time. And you talk to people about, don't expect this to be one job, be an influencer, and have people send you checks. It doesn't work that way.
I agree. Yeah, and what I've discovered to you is that you, for young leaders, you change jobs these days so often that what you really want to do is build a reputation for who you are.
Yes.
So you, it's sort of like you at Inc., and people look to you and know by word of mouth, you know, how good you are. And that's when things start happening and people bring things work to you. You don't have to go out and search for it. I can't remember for a long time when I had to go look for a job, because usually there was somebody there who wanted me to do this. And I bounced around. You bounced around some.
Oh, my gosh.
But it makes a bit. Yeah.
You can't hold a job if you're me and you. I mean, because people want you to do stuff. So that brings me to the last point. I interviewed General Mattis out at the library.
When did you do that?
Mad Dog Mattis is an amazing book. I mean, it's really one of the most remarkable books I've ever met.
Yes.
He said, call me Jim. And I said, I'm married to a Marine Corps colonel's daughter. I'm going to call you General forever. But he said, he has 7,000 books in his library.
Yes, he did.
And you and he and I believe in one thing, which is reading, reading, reading. Just expand on that for young people.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing about it is, if you want to be a leader, you can have classroom experiences, but there's nothing like going out and being in the arena itself and learning. And one of the ways that you can prepare yourself well for the public arena, whether you want to be in politics or policy or whatever it may be, is to become self-educated. To realize that you need to do some reading on your own, just as you need to develop your own values, what you believe in, what your purpose is in life, you know, what your moral purpose is in life. You need to figure that out for yourself. And reading and becoming a reader, I think it really strengthens you. I was out at the Harry Truman Library once, some years ago. Wonderful library, because there was humility about it. It wasn't one of the big, massive kind of libraries that presidents now have so often. And I was looking through some stuff, and I thought Truman was a wonderful president. He was starchy and just he was very strong. But Truman never went to college. The only president in the 20th century never went to college because his family was too poor when he graduated from high school. And he worked for 7 years behind a mule on a family farm before he went on to a haberdashery and political life. And Truman gave a speech. He had developed a speech he gave to the visiting high school students. And we used to tell, he used to tell them, these high school students, not every reader is a leader. But every leader is a reader. I climbed onto that, and I'm glad you mentioned General Mattis. He and I have been talking. He was very helpful in endorsing my book, and he and I would like to go out and do some things together. Because I've been with him 2 or 3 times. I don't know him as well as you do. But I share your great respect.
I've just interviewed him. That's all. And I envy you that opportunity. And I envy you writing a book as heartfelt and as important as Hearts Touched with Fire. David Gergen, always good to talk to you. Make sure Garen's on the right path. And I hope I see you down the road in the Beltway sometime.
That would be my pleasure and my privilege to you. Take care and thank you.
Thank you, David Gergen. That concludes today's episode of The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening. Make sure you come back and check out all the other podcasts on the Salem Podcast Network. And remember to thank our sponsors, AndrewandTodd.com. If you believe in long-form interviews like I do, then do your real estate transactions with Andrew Del Rey and Todd Avakian. I've known both men for a long time. AndrewandTodd.com. Go there, answer a couple of questions. They'll tell you what's best to do with your house, or call them at 888-888-1172. You'll be glad you did, and you'll be glad that you listened to the next episode of The Interview.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.